This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Local lodges and fraternal orders were once social pillars of their communities. But when WPR producer Chris Molina recently started watching AMC's Lodge 49 show, it made him wonder if that was still true. So he went to visit a few lodges around Madison to find out how things are.
That's a Lynx ring. You have to be a Lynx to get one.
Wow. How about that? What's a Lynx?
They're a fraternal order like the Masons or the Elks.
The Masons and the Elks. All right.
So I got married this past summer, and our wedding venue used to be a businessman's club like the Elks or the Eagles. I've also been watching the show Lodge 49 on AMC. It's about the fictitious Fraternal Order of the Lynx, which got me thinking,
what's inside?
Come inside, see for yourself.
You have your own tavern?
Through a bar.
Nice. Can I join?
So I decided to use the completely fictional Lodge 49 as a reason to check in with some real-life lodges here in Madison. I took some tours and talked with members at the Elks Lodge, the East Side Club, and the Masonic Center, which is home to several area Freemason lodges. Now, the golden era for these clubs was probably back in the 1950s, post-war. So how's membership doing now? Here's Paul Riley, president of the East Side Club.
Well, at that time, around 54, 55, those membership was about 1,000 people. And then membership started falling somewhat. And I got involved with the club about 95, 96, somewhere in there. And when I joined, membership was a little shy of 400.
And are your members getting older?
A lot of retired people. And that's a concern to us. Our membership continues to get older and older. We're probably over half, well over half our members are 65 or older.
Well, over at the Elks Lodge, Lynn Aspinwall has hope for the next generation, even in her own family.
I have a 22-year-old daughter, and I look around and go, how am I going to get her to join in 10, 20 years? Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, each of our members feel the same way. It's an opportunity to show them what we're doing in our community and then being able to say, you know, this is a great opportunity for you to be a part of it as well.
Lodge 49 looks like a lot of fun for the members.
Mainly we just get together. Tonight's bunko night.
Well, that sounds great.
But with membership down, do you have to come up with other ways to pay the bills? Paul?
32 teams come in here on Monday night and play bocce ball, and they drink beer. Mm-hmm. And then now we got one on Tuesday night because so many people wanted to join. We couldn't handle them all on Monday night. And then Wednesday night we have a Coombe League. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Not only am I familiar with it, I have played in the national championship of Coombe in Eau Claire, Wisconsin.
Okay. I was having somebody explain to me the scoring rules, and I thought, this guy ought to work for government because they seemed overly complicated. Not too many places with this view and this much lakefront. Private clubs, I think, as you'll find, are having a harder time of it. So what happens on a building this age, they're not very energy efficient, hardly any insulation at all. Being on the lake, the taxes are very high. So all this activity we do is called survival mode.
And these clubs have traditionally been male only, right, Lynn?
Absolutely. It was always a male-based organization. But I believe it was in the early 90s that they changed the charter to allow women to become members. But I think to increase our membership has always been our goal. So I think that's helped a little bit.
And let's hear from Craig Froelich, who's a member of the Scottish Rite of the Freemasons.
I really wish that there were more organizations like ours for women, where they could have the same experience without men stepping all over everything, you know. But in the end, it is a fraternity. We are a social organization for men. It's just that's the way it's been throughout our history.
So moving on, Lodge 49 likes to give fancy titles to its members. Over at the Elks Club, Lynn is the exalted ruler. That sounds awesome.
It's a fancy word for being the president of an association, but that's part of the ritual of the Elks. I'm very proud to be a third-generation exalted ruler at the Elks Club.
The Eastside Club has a pretty fun song as well that they sing at meetings. It even has three different origin stories.
I'm one of the newer members, but I've heard three versions of why you don't drink the water from the fountain. One is that really the old days, back in the 20s when this club was started, people would let their horses drink from the fountain. The other reason for more recent people my age, apparently in the hot days, a lot of the girls walking back from East High would put their feet in it to cool off. And the third, which is the best reason of all not to drink the water from the fountain, is one day a member saw a woman rinsing out a diaper. And the song is one of those things that the millennials say, what are you singing that for? And then we have the other half of the old timers saying, hey, that's tradition. Doesn't
it's
hurt
history,
anything.
Part of the history. Well, should we give it a go?
Sure.
We are the boys from the east side. We are the boys from the east side. We are the boys from the east side, but we never drink the water from the fountain round the corner of the street.
So there's the club song.
All right, well done. I think I recognize that tune. The Freemasons didn't sing us any songs, but Craig had this to say about camaraderie.
For a guy who's 23 years old to sit down and talk to across the table from a guy who's 85 years old and hear his stories, that's a very special thing. And you get that intergenerational face-to-face meeting that is just, that's one of the most valuable things that we have to offer. And
so now it's time to peel back the curtain and dish on the secrets and rituals that these clubs hold dear. Right, Craig?
We're not secret. People know about us. The secrets of Masonry, they're available anywhere. They were published in a book in the 1820s. They're all over the internet. And the big secrets, the real secrets of Masonry, are the confidence and trust between the brothers. And it could be he's having health problems, he's having financial problems, he's having family problems. He just wants somebody to confide in. I will keep that secret.
That sounds nice, but not very exciting. Come on, Paul, give me an East Side Club zinger.
We have bartenders mix up some kind of weird concoction that we call the water from the fountain around the corner of the street. I guess it's pretty bad. So after they're officially accepted, we have a pitcher of this stuff and pour them each a little bit in a glass and indoctrinate them.
Would you consider that a hazing ritual?
Well, it's very minor, but yeah. And it depends on the bartender.
All right, now we're getting somewhere. Okay, Lynn, how about you? What about the Elks?
Something that's very near and dear to our hearts is our 11 o'clock toast, which is a toast to our absent members, to our members who have deceased. A lot of us don't make it till 11 o'clock much these days, so we can, you know, once in a while we'll pass it off at 9 o'clock. Just taking a moment to reflect on what it means to be an Elk and to those that have gone before us.
So I'm left feeling like the fictional Lodge 49 got a lot of stuff right here, even though the show does get pretty weird and over the top at times. These places are a social outlet. They're about having fun, networking, and giving back to your community. The Elks work with kids and veterans charities, the Eastside Club provides college scholarships, and the Freemasons fund the Children's Dyslexia Center. And their doors are always open. Stop in and say hi.
So if you come back, we'll make you squire, and then you can attend meetings and run a tab at the bar.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks to WPR producers Carl Christensen, Brad Kohlberg, and Chris Molina for that fun segment. You can head over to WPR.org to watch some of the video footage they shot on their lodge tour.
Coming up, we'll learn about a Wisconsinite who took part in the freedom rides of the civil rights era.
Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum.
Geez Louise, comedian Charlie Behrens has had a huge year. As host of the Manitowoc Minute, he's performing sold-out shows across Wisconsin, and his online comedy news show is continuing to rack up tens of thousands of views. I recently caught up with Behrens to talk more about 2018.
Hey, dear folks, the Manduwalk Minute is one of the greatest news shows in all Wisconsin, the most trusted news show on Facebook, right up there next to Dem Russians. Keep her moving.
So you're back for the holidays. How's that been?
It's been cool. It's been fun coming up with another hour of material. And, you know, Wisconsin's kind of the thing, like, can you do the Wisconsin character? And how far can you go with that? And I'm always surprised by, like, the deeper I go, the more material there is. It's like exponential material.
There's like a constant hunger for people in Wisconsin wanting to make fun of themselves.
I think so.
This week's episode is brought to you by Stump Lake Liquor and Fireworks. Liquor and fireworks, they got it all. The only thing that's missing is your finger. Oh, that's why they call it Stump Lake.
What is it that Charlie Behrens likes to do when he's in Wisconsin with his family?
So we have a big celebration Christmas Eve. Like, I'm one of 12 kids, so everybody gets together. We exchange gifts. And this is my favorite part. We exchange a gift with somebody who we picked at Thanksgiving. But then we do this, like, roast of them. So it's like you get them a gift, but nobody really cares about the gift. They all just spend time, like, really trying to find the best roast of their sibling or mother, father, or whatever. So that's one of my favorite parts
that's
about Christmas.
That's very precious.
Yeah.
So 2018 was a big year for you personally.
Yeah.
But I've always wondered how you walk that fine line between bringing your personal views into either, whether it's on Twitter or through the Manitowoc Minute, but also not completely alienating this, like, very broad audience that you have.
I think a lot about that. What I am focusing on are issues that I believe, whether you're on the right or the left, we can agree on these things. You know, we can agree that racism is bad. We can agree the environment is good. We can agree that our troops do so much for us. It's important to honor them. I'm having conversations all the time with people on the right and people on the left because they come to the meet and greets after the show. And I feel like I'm getting a sense of where people are at. And nobody is at the Sean Hannity level. You know, nobody is at the Matt Owl, you know, the MSNBC Fox kind of thing, or nobody's there, you know? And those guys, I feel like, do a lot of damage because they are riling people up. For what reason? We need to find common ground. Your ratings should not be important enough that they start pitting people against each other.
And I thought you handled the Baraboo High School photo incident.
This guy, that's not a wave. Okay, calling that a wave is like calling a Mercedes a Toyota. Yeah, they're both cars, but only one was used by Hitler. That's a history joke. Speaking of history, we got to start taking it more seriously in high school and college before we repeat it.
I think you have to address an issue like that, see it for what it is, acknowledge it, and learn from it.
Hate can't fix hate. Only love can. I know that because I read it on the back of a Subaru last week.
I mean, you've had such a crazy year going to Lambeau, going to Miller Park during the playoffs. You have this beer named after you.
Yeah.
I, like, walk down the streets and I see people wearing their, like, Keep Removing T-shirts.
Nice.
I mean, that's crazy.
It is crazy.
So I'm wondering, for you personally, is it hard to balance who you are with your character? Like, even in this conversation, it's
say,
like, where does Manitowoc Minute Dude end, and where does Charlie Behrens begin?
It couldn't, I don't think, come across as authentic if it wasn't a serious part of me and who I am and, you know, how I grew up.
Well, thank you so much, Charlie, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. And keep her moving. Also, as always, go Packers and the Bears.
Comedian Charlie Behrens is the creator of Manitowoc Minute. And if you want to hear our full conversation, check out WPR's Beta. There, you can hear us talk about the biggest stories of the year, like climate change and the Packers. Just go to WPR.org/beta. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, the early 1960s were a tumultuous time in the United States. And in May 1961, the Congress of Racial Equality, or CORE, decided it was time to challenge segregation on interstate buses.
Those freedom riders risked their lives and changed the course of American history. And a Wisconsin author profiled some of the freedom riders through personal interviews, including one man from Wisconsin.
B.J. Hollers is an associate professor of English at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. He's the author of several books on the history of race relations in the U.S. His most recent is The Road South, Personal Stories of the Freedom Riders. B.J., welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
BJ, in hindsight, the Freedom Ride has become this legendary moment in American history. Take us back to just before it happened. It was this risky, uncertain outcome event.
Absolutely. You know, basically what happened was in the summer of 1961, a group of folks, black, white, young, old, northern and southern, got together on these interstate buses to test a few Supreme Court rulings. And they were met with bombs and beatings and even imprisonment along the way.
And the buses themselves, federal law, federal courts had integrated them officially. You weren't supposed to be able to enforce segregation laws at the local level on interstate buses. That wasn't happening, though. Segregation was still a reality.
That's exactly it. The key is interstate buses. And so the 1946 Morgan versus Virginia ruling made it very clear that this was unconstitutional. And then later, the 1960 ruling, Boynton versus Virginia, went even further to say the bus terminals, too, couldn't be segregated. And so the Freedom Riders really set out to test both of these rulings to see if local law enforcement would do their jobs.
And BJ, before we pick up their story, what led you to follow their path and ultimately to try to find and interview some of those Freedom Riders?
You know, I was having dinner with a friend here in Eau Claire one night, and he said to me, "Have you heard of Jim Zwerg?" And so I kind of went through my mental Rolodex trying to figure out if I did know Jim Zwerg. It sounded very familiar. And then when he said, you know, the Freedom Rider, it all came into sharp focus. A lot of folks may know Jim Zwerg's picture, even if you don't know his name. He was a tall white man from Appleton, Wisconsin, whose picture was on the front page of many national newspapers in May of 1961 after being beaten in Mount Montgomery. And so here were Wisconsin folks sitting down for breakfast, looking up at the newspaper and realizing, hey, a neighbor, a friend, someone from down the street, he's involved in this too, and maybe we should all take notice.
Let's follow Jim's story a little bit. From Appleton, as you said, a student at Beloit College, he shows up at school to meet his roommates.
That's correct. And one of his roommates is a guy named Bob Carter, who happened to be African-American. And so Jim and Bob became friends. They played basketball together. They walked around town together. And as their relationship grew, Jim began to realize that his friend wasn't being treated equally. And he couldn't quite get a handle on why that was. And so Bob introduced him to Martin Luther King's work, and Jim became very invested in the civil rights movement, so much so that he actually went to Fisk University and did an exchange program there, which is when he got involved in the movement.
And talk about how he got involved in that movement. What steps led along the way there?
Yeah, you know, it was kind of one thing led to another. So he was first in Nashville and noticing this group of folks picketing a movie theater. And that was curious to them. He'd never seen that before. So he went up to the man at the back of the line and asked him, you know, what are you guys doing? Turned out that man was a future seatmate of his on the Freedom Rides, John Lewis, Congressman John Lewis. And so he befriended John Lewis and began to integrate the movie theaters alongside these folks, and then shortly after grew into becoming a Freedom Rider himself.
Talking to BJ Hollers from UW Eau Claire, his new book is The Road South, Personal Stories of the Freedom Riders. He shares stories of people involved in the Freedom Ride, including one participant from Wisconsin. We're keying in on his story now, Jim Zwerg from Appleton originally. BJ, again, looking at it in hindsight, often it seems like the story is told that there is this protest movement, America United behind it. There are just a few bad guys pushing back against it. In reality, somebody like Jim faced a lot of pushback from his own family back here in Wisconsin.
Absolutely. And that's kind of an overlooked part of the civil rights movement generally, is kind of how families were sometimes divided as a result of the actions of one family member. And so while the Zwerg family was actually very progressive, they lived in Appleton. His father was a dentist and did quite a bit of free dental work to help folks and that sort of thing. When it came to putting their son's life on the line, to having their son call them up 3 days before leaving and saying, "I'm getting on this bus. I may not come back, but I need to do it," that really tore the family apart a bit. His father had just had a heart attack. His mother, the last thing she said to him before hanging up the phone that night was, "You're going to kill your father." And it wasn't the send-off that Jim Zwerg hoped for, to save the least, but it reaffirmed for him the importance of what he was doing.
And you mentioned a life on the line. We know a lot of people were attacked, met with bombs and assault, as you mentioned. And in that theater protest, Jim and one of his companions walked into the theater and were knocked unconscious, a hit from behind. That was their first experience with violence, not their
That's exactly right. That was Jim's introduction to violence, and of course it wouldn't be the last time he faced it. Jim often talks about kind of the way Klansmen would attack, and oftentimes the white male was the primary target because he was a traitor to the race. And so Jim very much got the brunt of the violence right alongside John Lewis, right alongside so many others on May 20th in Montgomery there. But again, it was his photograph, this white college-age kid in suit and tie, blood dripping down from his face, that really, I think, woke white America up.
And you mentioned years later, Jim Zwerg talked about being at an event, looking back, commemorating the Freedom Ride, and seeing that picture, that famous picture of him.
Absolutely. And he had this moment because as a result of his injuries, he wasn't able to continue the ride himself. And one of his fellow Freedom Riders said, Jim, you were with us the whole way. You inspired us to keep going. And so it was a very moving moment for him. And he got pretty emotional about that.
I focused for most of our talk here on this Wisconsin participant you profile. But can you talk about some of the common experiences of all the people you talk to get their stories about the Freedom Rides?
Absolutely. You know, one thing that really stands out is this incredible humility. You know, one of the Freedom Riders, a guy named Charles Person, according to his wife, he didn't even mention the fact that he was a Freedom Rider until about 15 years into their marriage. You know, that's how modest these folks were. But one thing they really taught me, too, is that anyone can be a hero. You know, you aren't born a hero. You become a hero by performing heroic acts. And so these were ordinary folks who felt strongly and were willing to put their lives on the line. And I think that's why it's such an important story today.
Is it an important story to tell today and to follow as you did the Freedom Riders Trail? You ultimately talked to them. Why is it important in 2018 to be talking about the Freedom Riders?
That's a great question. And that was sort of my primary aim. I didn't want to get the stories of what happened in the past and just leave it at that. I really wanted to ask them, where are we now? What can we do today? And I think the best example of this comes from a question that Freedom Rider Charles Person asked me, asked my students, asks a lot of folks. And it's a question that I ask folks when I talk to them during the readings. And his question is simply, what would you get on the bus for? And that question, of course, is really about what do you care about so deeply that you'd be willing to risk your life? And I think perhaps now more than ever, we have to think about that question on really pragmatic terms.
As we wrap up, do you think we're forgetting the stories of the Freedom Riders and the lessons we can learn from them?
You know, I sure hope not. Many Freedom Riders were a bit nervous about that very question. They said they worked so hard on the day-to-day fight for civil rights that they are afraid that their legacy might not inspire the next generation. And so I'm doing my very small part to make sure their voices can be heard and hopefully can do that inspirational work that they've certainly done for me.
BJ, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Rob.
BJ Hollers is an associate professor of English at UW-Eau Claire. He joined us from our WPR studios in Eau Claire to talk with us about his latest book, The Road South, Personal Stories of the Freedom Riders.
Coming up after the news, when we need someone to talk to, it seems like common sense that we'd reach out to the people closest to us, like family or friends. But one sociologist has found that we often confide in strangers or acquaintances. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up tomorrow after 6 on The Morning Show, host Dean Kallenbach welcomes a guest who shares tips to start 2019 out more organized. That's tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show.
Now, we all face difficult times in our lives. Maybe it's the prospect of divorce, news about a diagnosis, deciding to come clean about a dishonest act, moving older parents to a nursing home. The list goes on.
While the choice of who to confide in may seem obvious, a spouse, close friend, or family member, our next guest has learned that we often choose acquaintances or even strangers instead.
Mario Luis Small is a sociologist and Grafstein Family Professor of Sociology at Harvard University. He joins us to talk about his recent book, Someone to Talk To. Mario, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here, Rob.
Well, you in your book, you say when you're trying to explain what you're working on to people, you'd ask them a few questions that might be used in a sociological survey. Can you tell us about those questions to get us started thinking about who we talk to?
Yeah, it's a pretty standard set of questions. So imagine if I ask you in a survey, you know, from time to time, there are people we need to talk to when we have something important and personal to confide in someone. Who are the people in your life who you turn to? And what you find, if you're like me, is that most people will say something like, well, in my case, for example, it's my wife, it's probably my closest colleague at work, and maybe one of my closest friends from childhood who I've been in touch with for 30 years or so. But then what's interesting is that if you ask him a very different set of questions, you might get a very different answer. Suppose that instead of doing that, if I said, look, think about everything you're experiencing right now, and think about the two, maybe three most personally important, perhaps difficult things that you're going through right now, whatever they are. And Rob, I won't ask you to tell me, but just try to think about them. It could be something with your health, perhaps something with your relationships, maybe your finances, maybe some crisis that was unexpected. Just think about them. Now that you have them in mind, I'm going to ask you a very different question. Now think about the very last time you talked to anybody about that first thing you thought about, or the last time you talked to anyone about that second thing. Now, what's interesting is that when I think about this question, almost always, at least one or the two last people I actually talked to turn out to be people very different from who I would normally say are the people I usually confide in. And more importantly, those other people, the people I've often talked to, are sometimes people I'm actually not that close to. People who, in theory, aren't even the kind of people I would call my confidants. And that is the issue I started exploring.
And you write that this isn't just you, based on surveys and then based on your work for this book, following a group of graduate students in different departments. This is super common. We think of the people who are close to us as the people we'd talk to. Again, maybe that spouse, sibling, whatever. But when push comes to shove, the people we talk to are not always, not usually even those close people. How common is it for us to reach outside that close network to talk about the serious stuff?
Very, very common. So it turns out that if you ask people, there are lots of different ways of asking this question, but if you ask them just, hey, who do you think you talk to, or who are you regularly close to, they're going to name on average, at least Americans will name on average, somewhere between 3 and 4.5, 5 people, depending on how you frame the question. Now, I found using data representative of the U.S. population, we asked a nationally representative population this question, and we asked them who they'd actually talked to the last time they talked to anyone. And we found that just about half the time, actually technically speaking, slightly more than half the time, the people they'd last talked to about the issues they told us were the most important issues in their life that concerned them were not actually people they were close to.
So who are we talking to then? If it's not that close, what we might think of as our close support network, who do we find and why do we pick them?
Now, that's part of what's interesting about this. So first, we'll talk to, you know, pretty much anyone. Part of what's interesting is that if your listeners are like me, we tend to think of ourselves as pretty rational people who are not going to just go around and share our personal secrets or our personal difficulties with just any random person. But the truth is, if you look at the distribution of people that our respondents were willing to talk to, we're talking everything from bartenders, the person at the barbershop, the beautician at the nail salon, the person you're working out with at the gym, person in yoga class, a random colleague, a person who, you know, you run into on the elevator or a bus stop, or the person sitting next to you on the airplane. People actually will talk to a wide swath of people about their issues. Now, once you dig a little deeper, it gets a little more complicated because it turns out that people aren't just making decisions without thinking about them, although sometimes they actually are. But in truth, what ends up happening is people tend to turn to different people for different reasons. A lot of the time what happens is you're expressly trying to avoid the people you're close to, precisely because they're too close for comfort. Mm-hmm. You know, some people think about, the people who, well, they found a lump in their body and they don't want to worry their spouse until they know for sure. So it takes them a while. It takes them a while to go to the doctor and start talking about this. And it's only when they're really sure that they're going to talk to their spouse. Or maybe the problem they're having involves their spouse or involves someone they're close to. Maybe they've done something shameful, right? The person who, I don't know, is going through financial difficulties and, I don't know, cheated on their taxes. They're not going to want to tell their close friends often because they don't want those people to have a negative impression of them. So a lot of the times, even though it sounds strange at the beginning, what ends up happening is people are just avoiding the people they're close to.
Mario Luis Small is with us. He's a sociologist, author of the book Someone to Talk To. He's writing about who we confide in and why it's often not the people closest to us in our lives. You write about in the group of grad students you studied, one from a working class background at an expensive school, feeling like he was, you know, one problem away from kind of losing everything he'd built up toward. One person he didn't want to talk to was his mom for a variety of reasons. Can you tell us some of why he didn't reach out to that person who was close to him?
Absolutely. And this is part of what's interesting. I mean, I studied a population of graduate students. So even though they're, you know, pursuing higher degrees, they face as many problems as everyone else does. This was somebody who didn't have a lot of money. He was married. He had a child. And he had health insurance through his university. His wife, who was under 26, had health insurance through her own mother. But their child had no insurance. And so they were trying to get on Medicaid, et cetera. And they commuted to, he commuted to the office. And his big worry, that was one day, you know, he'd say, you know, gosh, if my truck breaks down and it's $1,000, we're done. I mean, I just have no savings, no nothing. Now, what's interesting is that this is something that, of course, worried him. And in addition to needing money, sometimes he just needed to talk about it. And what was powerful about his case is that even though just before we did our interview, he had told me that his mother was one of the closest people in his life and he was willing to talk to her about just about anything, he absolutely refused to talk to her about this issue. And the reason is simple. She was broke too. She didn't have a lot of money. She wasn't actually broke. She was poor. And so were his grandparents. And so he feared that the minute he brought it up, even if he was just trying to vent, you know, sometimes you just need to vent, oh my goodness, you know, the truck broke down or I don't know how I'm going to make it, that the mother would feel guilty and send him money that she didn't have, get into debt for his sake and so on. So it was a sense, in a sense, what he was trying to do was protect his own confidant, his own mother, from his own problems.
We had a caller who couldn't stay on the line who wanted to point out that programs like AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, or other anonymous support groups are based on principles of anonymity so people can share really the worst moments of their lives freely with people who, in many cases, don't know them at all. And it's easier maybe than talking to someone you're close to.
Absolutely. And actually, I think to the extent that programs such as AA and NA work, a lot of the reason they work is the opportunity for people to just vent, to talk in a context, not just without judgment, and not just where your family, who you may be embarrassed or ashamed or have a hard time talking to, are going to be there, but also where people are going to understand. You know, Rob, that's one of the most important things we found, that often when people were going out and seeking people they were not close to, people who were basically sometimes even strangers, the major thing they were looking for was cognitive empathy, the sense that this person is going to understand my experience as I experience it. And that is one of the most powerful things that people often in places like AA report themselves finding.
Mario Luis Small is with us. He's a professor of sociology at Harvard University. We're talking about who we choose to confide in when dealing with tough situations and why we choose them.
And what about you? If you think about something in your life that's difficult to handle, is the last person you talk to about it someone close to you? Or have you confided in a stranger or acquaintance? How did it make you feel, and was it helpful? And how do you know you've chosen the right person to confide in? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know.
We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking with Mario Luis Small, professor of sociology at Harvard University. We're talking about his most recent book, Someone to Talk To, and about our social networks, who we go to when we've got something serious to talk about.
And we want to hear from you. When you're dealing with a heavy situation like depression, choosing to come out publicly, or maybe having an affair outside of your relationship, who do you find yourself turning to? Have you ever had a stranger confide in you? Or have you ever turned to someone you don't know very well to unload your thoughts and feelings? Did it help? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know.
Mario, let's talk a little bit about what we can do with this, because it seems like this would have some practical application, this way of thinking about things, if we're trying to figure out ways to make it possible for, say, someone to report sexual harassment at work or bullying at school. Are there lessons we can draw here to find the right person for them to talk to?
Absolutely. So I would say sort of probably the most important lesson has to do with forgetting the assumption that that people need to be really close to the person who needs to talk in order for them to be good confidants. The truth is, most of us, even if we don't see ourselves as very good listeners or very good speakers or whatever it is, can and have probably more often than we typically realize, serve as confidants for others. One of the most powerful things I learned when studying this book was I was looking at the experiences of teachers who worked in public school districts where the fact that they were gay or lesbian was problematic. And so they had to keep it to themselves because it might have an impact on how they were evaluated professionally. Now, one of the very interesting things I learned in that context is when many of these teachers eventually ended up coming out, they did so to people who just happened to be present and willing to listen at the time they needed to do it. In other words, the predicament, this was in the 1990s. This was some narratives of people who were at a time in a context where there was less openness about sexuality than there is now, even though, as we all know, there's still we still have a ways to go. And one of the most powerful things I learned from their experiences was that really the presence of somebody willing to talk is more important than the fact that that person has an especially close relationship to you. I would say a second quick lesson that's powerful is the importance of empathy over sympathy. Now, we often think about sympathy as being important, being sympathetic. But the truth is, a lot of what I found is that most of the people who were looking for an ear weren't actually looking for sympathy so much as empathy. So sympathy is sort of the sense of sorrow or pity, kind of what you feel for the suffering of another person. When you're seeing the hungry child on the television, and you see the plea for help, but what the thing that's prompting you to write the check is sympathy. It's not really empathy. Because empathy, at least cognitive empathy, is the ability to experience what someone else is experiencing. Unless you've experienced prolonged hunger, you actually don't cognitively understand what that person is experiencing. What you're feeling is really sympathy. But it turns out empathy, the ability to get what someone else is going through, it turns out to be really, really important when people are looking for someone to talk to.
I want to bring in a caller who might fit into that point. Tom is with us in Neenah. Tom, hi.
Hi. Great show. I just want to say, as a guy whose wife has Alzheimer's dementia, I found myself unable to talk about things in certain ways with our kids, some of whom are in denial and some of whom they're all over the spectrum. So we formed a support group, started with just two of us, of men who have wives with Alzheimer's, and we talk about things in an entirely different way. And to your point, aren't looking for sympathy. We're all in a bad boat. We're looking for empathy, but also kind of practical advice and a feeling of I've been where you are or, you know, and got through it or that kind of feeling. So I was never much of a believer in support groups. This changed my feeling about it, and I never thought about it in terms that your guest has put it until I heard this show. So thank you for that.
Thank you so much for calling in, Tom. I'm glad you found someone to talk with about that. And there is exactly what you were just saying, I think, Mario. He's not looking for sympathy. He's looking for somebody who's experienced the same things, bounce stories off each other and ideas. And I've heard we've talked to veterans on the show in the past who said, yeah, the best people to talk about my veteran stuff with is other veterans. Yeah. That's a great example that Tom gave us.
Absolutely. It's absolutely right. And it's actually pretty much spot on. What's interesting about this and what Tom, I think, illustrated for us is we don't really often want to think of ourselves as people who need sympathy or help or pity. And part of the reason he hadn't done it before is perhaps it sounds like sort of that issue. But the need to hear someone else understands what you're going through is actually quite powerful and cathartic. And I'm actually glad to hear that he was able to find a way to find a support group where he could just talk and talk openly and frankly in a way and in a way that others would understand and in a way that even his own children perhaps were having some difficulty with.
Tom, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to David with us in Milwaukee. David, hi.
Hi. Yeah, you know, I have a couple, like two friends I can talk to, two men friends I can talk to about when I got something going on. And one of the things I find is being a friend is being a good listener, be slow to speak and quick to listen, you know, and just hear them, hear the person out. Let them say, you know, don't be quick to respond. You know, I find it very helpful for when a friend's telling you, kind of laying their soul out. And I find that it's really helpful for me and for them, you know, to just listen. Sometimes I can remember as a teenager just wanting someone to talk to, and I couldn't find anyone to talk to. It was just worst possible thing in the world, thinking there was no one you could talk to about what you had going on. And I've always made myself available for people to do that. But like I said, be slow to speak and quick to listen, you know. And a lot of times people just want to be heard.
Gotcha. David, thank you so much for sharing that. Yeah, is that what people often are looking for, Mario, just to be heard, not necessarily a solution?
Absolutely. And in fact, I love that phrase, slow to speak and quick to listen. I think a lot of the time, in a lot of the cases that we saw, that's precisely what people were looking for. And, you know, the opportunity for that listener to be somebody who will just get you. Literally, they will just get what you're talking about. They don't have to give you advice, necessarily. They don't have to really often do much more than get what you're talking about. That benefit was surprisingly powerful for many of the people we spoke to.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Mario Luis Small, author of Someone to Talk To. We'll go next to Kathy on the line in Madison. Kathy, hi.
Well, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, what'd you want to tell us about, Kathy?
Well, I dated a fellow in a 12-step program who has been sober for a long, long time and initially had a job as a cab driver. And he told me that he did his 10th step, which is a confessional step, with his captive audiences in the form of his cab patrons.
Wow.
And he's been, so he goes to meetings regularly and talks about his, you know, whatever's going on with him as well. It's not like he just did it and is done with. Mm-hmm. But initially he was working through those steps, and I don't know how his cab patrons felt about it, but he worked through those steps as appropriate, and he's been sober ever since. So.
Kathy, well, congratulations to him, and thanks for sharing that story. So I assume some people have done the opposite and given their story to the cab driver. Here's a cab driver taking the 10th step with his fares.
That's terrific.
Did you talk to people on the receiving end? Are people, like, if we want to talk to that acquaintance, you know, somebody outside of our network, our immediate network a little bit, are people cool with that generally?
You know, so what's interesting is the answer is yes. So what I love about the cab driver example is the cab drivers are actually often in the opposite role in a way that many people in jobs where they're captive listeners end up being. So a cab driver is a lot like a bartender, and it's a lot like a barber, and it's a lot like the person, like the beautician, in that these are a lot like a trainer at a gym. These are people who have a job. Technically speaking, their job is not to formally listen to you, but who have a job in which the context is intimate and the opportunity to talk is there, and often end up being the confidence for a whole bunch of people.
Mario, briefly, as we wrap up, in all this research, if after the show today someone comes up to me or whoever's listening and has that story, what advice do you have as the listener, that confidant of almost random choice, if that happens?
The most important thing I would say is you don't actually have to solve anyone's problems. Listening is half the battle.
It's a good place to leave it. Mario, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Rob. It's been a pleasure.
Mario Luis Small is a sociologist and professor of sociology at Harvard University. He joined us to talk about his book, Someone to Talk To.
And you can keep the conversation going over on Twitter. Does it make sense to you that it might be easier to talk to a stranger about difficult and personal things? Have you ever done that? Or has someone done it with you? What was that like? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know.
Coming up Thursday on Central Time, if you're part of a couple, how do you handle finances? We'll talk about different approaches and find out how to decide which one is best for you.
We'll also talk about the best fiction for 2018, and we'll want to hear from you about your favorites.
And we'll look back at the year in weather.
All that and more coming up Thursday on Central Time.